The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Observatory straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
I basically just think it'd be interesting to look at the emergence of a criminal economy.
And also, I'm always amazed that there aren't more profiles of her out there.
This really subversive, strange thing in rap, especially.
And see what their lives are like on both sides of the border.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. A new show by David Simon isn't just a new television show. It's a real event. Critics have compared him not so much to other showrunners, but to 19th century novelists like Charles Dickens. 15 years ago, he created The Wire on HBO, and it traced the underworld and politics and street life of Baltimore. It was an ambitious piece of sociology as much as it was great storytelling. It was dense, it was raw, challenging, and not a few people say it was the best thing ever created on television. What The Wire did for the drug trade in Baltimore, Simon's new show The Deuce does for sex work and the rise of pornography in 1970s New York.
So, what's it like, Shay?
Well, I'm just starting. Loretta could tell you. She's been sunlight all year.
Really?
Sunlight.
Making movies during the day.
For the machines.
Yeah.
But you only get paid once.
Same as Trick.
No, every time some guy puts a coin in one of those machines, someone's making money off what you did, and you're not making another dime.
But you do it, Darlene, right?
The New Yorker's TV critic Emily Nussbaum called The Deuce a drama full of hardcore sex and violence, but one with an elastic generosity, a willingness to see even the ugliest phenomena through curious eyes. I spoke with David Simon last week. As I understand it, you and George Pelicanos, your collaborator on this program, had a conversation with somebody who sparked this idea. Tell me about that.
We were working on Treme, and the assistant locations manager was a fellow named Mark Henry Johnson, and he encountered this guy and befriended him and taken down tape after tape after tape of his memories of being a mob front, for the mafia, for the Gambino family on 42nd Street. Ran a bar up near the Brill Building that became quite famous in its day as sort of a demi-mon joint. Ran an after-hours club later on.
What was the name of the place?
If I say that, I think it identifies him. And he's passed away, and so has his twin brother. But I kind of feel like there's a lot of kids and grandkids. And since the story is not, it's not all heroics, I'm not sure that I have permission, if that makes sense.
Fair enough.
But anyway, Mark said, you got to come meet this guy. You got to hear the stories. You know, it's about the rise of pornography. It's this moment where porn went from being under the counter, back alley in the basement, to being the beginnings of a multi-billion dollar industry and a legitimate one.
And what kind of stories was he telling you?
About all the people he knew and what happened to them and who survived and who didn't and who was attrited and what happened and, all the lies within the truths and truths within the lies. But we didn't know that. We thought, oh, great, it's a porn story. So George and I put him off and put him off. And finally, we were coming up here for a sound mix, I think, on Treme. And I said, George, you know, let's just get this all over with because, you know, it'll be an hour. We'll shake hands. We'll be at the door. 3.5 hours later, we walked out of Mark's apartment in Tribeca after, you know, listening to the guy for 3.5 hours. He wasn't done, but we were just, we pretended to go need a cigarette. Neither one of us smoke. And we walked around the block and said, my God, I think we're going to do a story about the rise of pornography. I mean, the stories were that compelling.
This season is 8 episodes. When the first episode opens, the world that we're in is the world of streetwalkers and pimps, not the world of porn. What happened?
Well, I mean, there was. Listen, there's been pornography since the—
No, there's been skin magazines and
right.
the rest.
Right. Since the first French guy invented the camera
right.
and said, you know, he ran down the street looking for Parisian hookers to take their clothes off. And there's been prostitution since, you know, since I believe our testament. So nobody invented these things. But what happened around 1971 was the New York City courts began interpreting the inherent confusion over what is obscene in a very, you could either say pragmatic or laissez-faire way, which is to say we're done chasing this nonsense around to no particular point because we can't obtain convictions anywhere above an appeals court, and the Supreme Court can't even give us any real guidance. So we're going—
So it was the courts more than the sexual revolution that did this?
And there was sort of a hollowed-out notion of what is the standard. And of course, you know, what are community standards in Times Square? They're very different from the rest of America. So it happened here, and it happened with mafia money. And suddenly what was under the counter in a very short span of time became legal and unregulated.
I want to play a clip from the show. There's a scene where Maggie Gyllenhaal's character, a prostitute who goes by the name of Candy, she has a kid as a client, a kid who clearly it's his first time having sex or anything close to it. And not surprisingly, he has an orgasm in no time flat. And he wants seconds.
What do you do, Stuart?
I'm in school.
What's your daddy do?
He sells cars. He's got a dealership.
And that's his job, right? Someone comes in, knows just the car he wants, doesn't dick around, doesn't need a long test drive, doesn't argue about the color or whatever. Does he give him the car for less? Does he pay less? Then the guy who comes in, takes forever, gotta drive 5 or 6 cars, talk about the radio, the white walls, everything else before he's done and ready to buy? No. He doesn't give the easy customer 2 cars for the price of 1, right? This is my job, Stuart.
There is, as there is in The Wire and everything else you do, David, a really powerful sense of labor and even the dignity of labor in this.
Even when it's undignified.
There.
That's exactly right, which is to say, I think our hearts, no matter where we go, whether it's recon Marines or trombone players or drug dealers or cops or sex workers, our hearts are either with— it's either on the assembly line or it's with middle management. You know, I think that's where our point of view is always strongest. I think that's what we're trying to convey. And then we're trying to show you, well, so where does the power and the money route itself? And if we sort of fail to do those two things, if we fail to create a world where real people seem to be laboring and trying to scratch out an existence, a plausible existence, and if we fail, I think, to address what they get and what they don't get in more macro terms, then I think we probably screwed up our mission.
Unless I'm crazy, one of the dominant themes of this is not just systems and economies and relationships of that kind, but misogyny.
Oh, yeah.
And this is created by David Simon and George Pelicanos, and Richard Price is a dominant writer here. But your writer's room is really interesting.
Right.
Tell
me
about
that. You just played from the first few. And yes, you know, when we were trying to establish the template, I relied on the writers that, you know, I came to the dance with many years ago on the Wire. But in order to shape the whole story and to bring it to a point, that it needed to be. This could in no way be the boys' version of sex work, the boys' version of pornography.
So how do you assemble a writer's room? How many people are in it and who's in there?
Well, I chase novelists. That's my conceit, which is I'd rather have people who know how to write a multi-POV novel than people who know how to write television. I can fix what ails a scene in terms of television. I can't fix content and I can't fix voice.
But even in the so-called golden age of television, you don't have faith in that?
No, I don't. I don't want somebody who can deliver a clinical 43-minute and 30-episode on TV. I want somebody who can write a novel to conclusion that has a beginning, a middle, and end. So, George was the first guy that I sort of threw it at. And then he and I went together to get Price. And then, on this one, we went for Megan Abbott and Lisa Lutz. We needed the woman's voice in the room. We needed to be argued out of our own sensibilities. We needed to be argued into other sensibilities.
Tell me about some of those arguments. Give me an example.
I'm trying to think. The one that I'm coming up with right now is not particularly substantive, but it's telling. There's a character named whose name in the scripts was Thunder Thighs. She's a heavyset girl heavyset woman who's working the corners. And she was named Thunder Thighs because that's what the original guy whose stories it was knew her as. We didn't have her real name. We had what he remembered her as, and that was her street name. So she was that in the script. First moment when we brought women on and they looked at the scripts and they said, can this person have a name? And instantly I think I felt a level of shame that like I didn't anticipate. It was like, she absolutely can have a name and I'm sorry.
You're way better.
Yeah, you're way better. But it was much more substantive than that. I mean, there's a conversation in one of these later episodes where the working girls are in the diner and they all just want to get rid of the pimps. And they start talking about menstruation. And they start talking about it in the most hyperbolic terms.
You hear about these sponges? You stick it up there, stops the blood long enough to fuck. Johns can't tell the difference. But you need to be careful. He gave me a yeast infection once.
Larry, one of the pimps, throws down his fork, shoves his plate away, and walks away. And then they can talk because he's not around. It was one of the most fundamentally feminist scenes in the piece. And it was, I think it was Lisa Lutz, if I'm remembering correctly, she delivered that one. So, I mean, what you're looking at is that's something, I would not have thought to write that scene. And if I did write it, I literally would have gotten to the parts about, I would have gotten to all the, all the genital realities and said, or the venereal realities and said,
you would have run away.
Yeah. Can a PA come in here and tell me,
I think anybody who's watching this show has got to be casting their heads forward to where this lands, which is to say porn on every phone and computer and all the rest, the ubiquity of porn and the effect it's had on...
On men.
How do you feel about the effect of porn on society?
Well, listen, I come from newspapers. I'm a First Amendment literalist. I don't see any means to regulate speech, open speech. But I think this has happened so fast that we've gone from, in 50 years, from stealing your dad's Playboy or Penthouse magazine for a 12-year-old to having any form of pornography, regardless of how sort of misogynistic the imagery might be available at your fingertips without intercession to that same 12 or 13-year-old. We've gone so fast. I'm not sure we've taken stock of just how profoundly.
You think it's affected consciousness in a way?
Absolutely. I certainly think it's even affected political consciousness in the country. I don't think some of the things that were said in this last campaign cycle and accepted, and not just the pussy grabbing, which is of course the most startling moment. I mean, if you think back two political generations, maybe one and a half, to Jimmy Carter and lusting in his own heart in 1976. A very Christian, very sincere comment when asked about infidelity, that he had lusted in his own heart for other women. It nearly capsized his campaign. Trump barely broke stride after the tape came out. It was really a remarkable moment of...
And you think that's linked somehow to porn?
I think the blunt ubiquity of pornography has made the terminology and the demeanor with which men address women now, I think it's transformed it. Yeah, and I think you really see it in you know, give men the slightest bit of anonymity. You know, you have a lot of writers at the New Yorker. I imagine that what comes across the transom in terms of social media or comments at women more than men, you know, never fail. I mean, women are used to it. If you ever get used to it, women have now been putting up with it for 10, 15 years of the internet. It's astonishing. I'm, you know, my wife is a novelist. What comes across at women nowadays?
She gets letters. She gets emails.
You know, she has a website. You know, and I mean, you know, you kill it out and you keep moving. And you know, obviously the anonymity is part of the dynamic. But what men feel entitled now to say and to think and to even argue, I think is entirely informed by a 50-year run-up.
That porn itself influences the misogyny directed at a
candidate. And the misogyny pushes porn. I mean, I think it's quite a cycle.
All these projects and all your reporting and all your thinking in your adult life has led you to have what politics, David?
I'm lefty.
How lefty?
You know what? I'm left-wing on about 85% of the issues.
And where not?
I got no patience for anything that interrupts the idea of open speech. I find what's going on college campuses to be incredibly naive, almost childlike. I'm very disappointed in it. I think dissent, open dissent, requires speech in order to survive, particularly in a time of an authoritarian government. And the idea that you would trade that away over some schnook that's saying some stupid stuff in a Berkeley lecture hall is embarrassing to me. It's like, you would trade this weapon for that? That's not even tactical. So there are moments where I just walk, I listen to the left and I walk away and I say, man, you know, you never fought the way it has to be fought in your life. And that's why you just came up with that answer. But there are other times where I find myself to the left of the Democratic platforms. I mean, you know, I think there should be a guaranteed income. I think we've reached the point in terms of the death of work and where we're going as a society and automation that we should already be guaranteeing people a basic income, which, frankly, Richard Nixon got close to doing.
He did.
And was told, this will work. You know, you give somebody $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, you give families that kind of money, it's all going back into the economy. It's not going into mutual funds. It's going right back. It's going right back into the economy. It would be an incredible boon to the country, and it would honestly take into account the fact that we don't need as many Americans to run this economy as we once did.
You started out as a journalist and a damn good journalist, and I think you have a kind of love and some hate relationship to what lingers in journalism. How do you feel about it now, and do you have any plans to sort of make anything more than an op-ed like a re-entry into journalism?
You know,
because I could think of a good place for you to write.
Is that an invitation?
It's always been an invitation.
Well, I owe you a piece.
You do.
I owe you a piece. I mean, there are parts of me that think there's going to come a point where you don't want to sit in those goddamn deck chairs at 4 a.m. at 164th Street, you know, and wait for them to move the light. And at that point, maybe you should be writing prose again.
All right, then I'm patient.
Because then it's you and it's an editor and a copy editor. And, you know, and maybe a photographer.
Well, I'll wait for that day, and in the meantime, yeah. I'm loving this work.
Oh, well, thank you.
David, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
David Simon. The Deuce, which Simon created with George Pelicanos, is on HBO. Ahead this hour, more crime, but slightly politer crime. Financial crime. That's coming up on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. And here's Ellie Kemper from Kimmy Schmidt and The Office with a little aspirational story called If I Were a Ballerina.
Deep down, I've always known that I have what it takes to be a ballerina. In fact, when I see other ballerinas, it's hard not to feel a little smug. Here these guys are, thinking they're so great. And here I am, confident that I would be better. For example, I'd know everything there is to know about ballet. You'd quiz me on a ballet fact, and I'd know it instantly. Something like, who was the first person to blah blah ballet something? Before you even finished asking your question, I'd say, this person! And you'd look up the answer, and I would be right. Every time. If I were a ballerina, I wouldn't broadcast it. I would grand jeter to and fro, here and there. I would grand jeter all over town. You're probably thinking, but wouldn't that let people know that you're a ballerina right away? Jesus, I would grand jeter very quietly, all right? I would grand jeter so quietly that if you noticed and thought something of it, like maybe that I was a ballerina and you happened to be impressed by that, well, that would be on you for looking, wouldn't it? If I were a ballerina, I'd work tirelessly at my craft. Why do you work so hard when you're already an incredible ballerina? Friends would ask. I'd smile and respond, my friend, how do you think I became an incredible ballerina? By lying around like some lazy piece of shit? Is that how you think I became an incredible ballerina? I would also do charity ballet things if I were a ballerina. Put a tutu on a shelter dog, teach a tutu-wearing shelter dog to plie, enter a tutu-wearing plie shelter dog in a contest, win. And then Jessica from work would hear about all the good I was doing on top of being an incredible ballerina, and she'd be like, ah! Yes, if I were a ballerina, even my very worst enemies would have to admit, she's good at what she does. Ballet.
That's Ellie Kemper performing If I Were a Ballerina, a story written for The New Yorker's Daily Shouts by Kelly Conaboy. And this is The New Yorker Radio Hour.
What's going on, man?
Talking to A, that's my OG, gave me my name, must have been 13.
Wiki is the stage name of a rapper who was born Patrick Morales. He started making a name in rap circles here in New York when he was just in high school. He formed a collective with his friends called Letter Racer. A few years later, Wiki's debut album is just out, and it's getting great reviews in the music press. The record is called No Mountains in Manhattan, which is a true statement. and it's kind of a love letter to the city.
Posted at the crib, kids clowning, change for the bus lounging. City park kids running.
Last year, nightlife editor Matt Trammell talked to Wiki for the Radio Hour after he released his mixtape called Lil Me. The songs are about growing up and moving out of his mom's house uptown.
Yeah, we're in Chinatown. This is the crib, the Letter Racer headquarters, kind of, you know what I mean? But we live here, too. That's the kitchen. It's pretty regular in there. There's some bugs and stuff.
So Wiki is a pretty tiny kid, big mat of hair. He has two missing front teeth, but he wears it well.
This is my room right here.
You guys record out of this bedroom?
Yeah, we record right here. Sammy hosts me out with recording. He lives with us, too.
His apartment was a bit of a flop house for him and his friends. A bunch of art on the walls and junk all over the ground, flip-flops everywhere. How long you been here, Wick?
I've been here, about a year.
Growing up.
Yeah.
Talks a lot about, you know, the sort of transitional moment that he's in, growing up, being from the city and sort of seeing the country, touring as an artist, and made this really great song about moving out of his mom's apartment. Tell you about living with my mom. Still smoking blunts out of the window when she gone. Let me tell you about living while we're gone. I'm ripping it and they spitting it right along. Let me tell you about living with my mom. Still smoking blunts out of the window. I really, really loved the record and the video, Living With My Mom. Like, I was a fan of yours for some time, but that video just felt so different for you to do, so fun, so funny. The song is just, like, a dope song, and it's something that I think a lot of people your age can relate to,
I mean, it's just, like, regular growing up, but it was kind of cool because it was, like, I was traveling a lot. Like, we would be in Europe and be, in like, around the country. I'm on the road, I'm driving, I'm flying, I don't even know. It's wherever the label tell me to go. Whatever I'm able to get better, show. Yeah, I know it, live it, spitting, getting money that I blow. Everything's popping off, you're like in the hotel, you're like getting put up somewhere, but then when you go back home, it's just like regular old, like still like trying to sneak around and smoke, like when your mom's like not there, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. She's like folding clothes for you to send you off into the tour van. You know, you don't necessarily have that these days.
Now I'm like free to like chill, but I gotta like grow up and learn to clean my room.
Yeah. There's trade off, right? So how far away is your mom's apartment now? Like, do you guys live?
Oh yeah, she lives uptown on the Upper West Side, in like 86. She's not far. I should probably visit her more, but she's still not there.
Actually,
she came out to when we played in Philly. She came out.
Oh nice.
So it was cool.
Okay.
She saw it. We're lucky, people from New York, kids from New York, because I know kids that be out here and they're like, yo, I lost my job, like, I have to go back to Michigan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
But, like, for us, we're like, oh, yeah, whatever, and then, like, you just kind of can go back and sleep on your mom's couch if you really, you know what I mean? Like, I got to go back to the Upper West Side.
Right,
come on,
right,
like,
right.
Like, you know what I mean? Like,
and she's still, like, you can come home anytime, this music stuff. Something doesn't work out, you could come home.
I don't know. She is a little hard on me, but she would definitely hold me down for sure. Yeah.
Wiki, you're how old?
22.
And you grew up on the Upper West Side.
Yeah.
You went to school up there. Where did you go to school?
110th.
Okay.
Cathedral School. And then I went to Brooklyn Friends for high school.
Okay. Nice. I know a lot of kids that went to private schools in New York,
mm-hmm.
and it's like one of the strangest like demographics of New Yorkers,
I would say. Yeah, and it's like Slicky Boy be chilling with Madonna's daughter. Like, you never know, you know what I mean? Like, that's the New York shit. Like, that's tight.
There's kind of like an equalizing that like happens. You're all still like knuckleheads.
For sure.
The Arnold Palmer video you guys put out, there's like Genesis Evans and like this rapper and like, there's like all these kids from like all these different little pockets
that kind of
get like brought together by like one thing. Called you back on 66 and we met back for the three and we went wherever we went all the time we spent him. Oh, now we paying rent, but we won't forget where he's from where he went, where he's from. We some muds.
We're all just kind of like weirdos, I think, honestly. We're all unique, they're characters, you know what I mean? And it's like, when I was younger, I always thought you have to be like, oh, are you into rap? Are you into like punk? Are you into this? Like, all these things. But what's cool about New York, it's kind of, I guess also the internet opened that up. Everyone's kind of into everything. But I realized, like, I don't have to be, like, the rapper kid or the punk kid. I can be in a punk band and be rapping and do, you know what I mean? Like, kind of just, like, be me, you know what I'm saying? Whatever I was into.
Can I make a follow with a few words? Just say I want to know what you're about.
So I definitely came to talk about Lil Me, the mixtape that you put out in December.
Yeah.
That was like your sort of first solo Wiki project since Rat King really took off. Rat King was about contrast between like noise stuff and rap stuff,
and
you sort of like piercing through all of that. Lil Me just sort of cleared everything up.
Yeah, well, I knew I wanted to work on a solo project, and then I feel like Rat King I would write more like for like the city or something or for everyone. This was more like personal. I think probably one of the first verses I wrote for that was like on Lil Me, the track, where I'm like, my wife, tell me you gotta pray before my flight, do it for a sake and for a sight, you know what I mean?
Do it just to make it through the night. I'm a seismonize, try to check, hit it with my fingers in it at its height. Thinking that I'm little at the sight. I'm bigger cause I'm bright. Words speak volumes, I'm riddling it right. Y'all can't even fiddle with the mic. Hat the kids, days out, need riddling the right. If you're kidding, I'ma get them when it's right. Gotta wait for the right time.
I remember writing that when my girl was like asleep on the couch. And then like I remember talking to Sport and being like, yo, I need a beat for this.
It's a great wide world, it's just Lil Wo Me. It's just Lil Wo Me, baby.
You get into it on the record, but what does that title mean to you?
Well, yeah, it's just like realizing like the world's bigger than the city, kind of, and like growing up a bit. And it's like, but growing up, but then realizing I'm still young, you know what I mean? Like, and that's part of growing up, being able to call yourself immature, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just Lil Me, like, take it for what it is, and like, but then kind of like having pride behind it.
If it ain't God in the city, no me, in the train, in the pump, in the ab, in the street. We the muscle just sitting smoke blunt, so you see, sitting top of stoop, thinking, who really run the city? That's me, still getting hit with dickens, doing the shit we need. I'll get it, man, try to do me till I'm dead, man. Always was a little kid, and I will. Little
Nightlife editor Matt Tramiel spoke with the rapper Wiki last year. Wiki's album on XL Records, No Mountains in Manhattan, is out now.
Never try to take me down with it, getting used to the thought. When I'm feeling you just trying to get juiced in the thought. Gotta value my life, gotta wipe down home, so I gotta be a thought. Gotta be a grown ass man with a job. This is Lil Wo Me, baby. Me in the train, in the in the but tell me, though, what does that mean? This is Lil Wo Me.
Staff writer Sheila Kolhatkar writes frequently about Wall Street and finance. Her colleague Patrick Radden Keefe also writes about business, but more often he covers shady business, drug trafficking and the like. Patrick reviewed a book called, we're going to have to bleep this for the radio, The Chicken Shit Club, which argues that the Department of Justice has gotten awfully skittish about prosecuting people in finance. Not long ago, Patrick and Sheila sat down to talk about why nobody seems to go to jail for financial crimes anymore, and how that's impacted the country.
So Patrick and I met several years ago in a federal courthouse not far from here. I believe it was 40 Foley Square. Does that sound right to you?
I think so. It seems right.
And if I'm remembering this correctly, I was going through security and you were right behind me.
Was I? I guess we spent a lot of time in the security line.
We did, but Patrick and I were both there covering this really high-profile insider trading trial of Matthew Martoma, a former hedge fund trader at SAC Capital.
This was a big insider trading trial in the Southern District of New York when Preet Bharara was the U.S. attorney, and there had been a whole series of these insider trading cases, and I actually felt like kind of an interloper because in that press box were all of these reporters from Bloomberg, the FT, the Times, Reuters, who seemed to all know each other because they'd covered one after another of these big insider trading cases.
Well, this case really was sort of the crowning case of his campaign against insider trading at hedge funds. And at that time, which was late 2013, early 2014, he was boasting this incredible record in insider trading prosecutions. I mean, at one point it was over 80-0 guilty pleas and convictions. And this made his reputation, and this really sort of marked him as the enforcer of Wall Street. Why do you think there were so many insider trading prosecutions?
It was interesting because that was the first big piece that I'd written about white-collar crime. And to me, it seemed as though we were coming in on this real crusade against this very specific type of crime. But as I was reporting that story, I spoke to some people who essentially said, you know, it's great and all that he's prosecuting these insider trading cases, but this is kind of a sideshow. We had already had the financial crisis unfold, and there was evidence of all kinds of fraud and decidedly risky behavior on the part of the banking sector, which had had huge, just cataclysmic economic effects. And there were a lot of people I spoke with who said, again, there's no question that there are people who are guilty of insider trading, but the idea that this would take up such a disproportionate amount of prosecutorial resources is a little curious.
Well, this has been really widely criticized in terms of, you know, how the government handled the financial crisis.
So it's fascinating. I wrote an essay in the magazine about a book called The Chicken Shit Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives, by Jesse Eisinger, who's a reporter with ProPublica. And a big thrust of his argument is that the Justice Department may have pursued certain types of cases, insider trading cases, certainly Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is another area where there have been prosecutions of white-collar executives, but that when it came to the underlying causes of the financial crisis, the Justice Department essentially gave a pass to the big banks and to the white-collar executives who were responsible for getting us into this mess.
So this might be a good moment just to describe the anecdote that led to the title of this book, The Chicken Shit Club. Can you tell us where that comes from?
Yeah, so it's a great story. James Comey, before he was the household name, James Comey, was the head of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. And Eisinger tells this story about how when Comey came in, he assembled the troops. He assembled a bunch of his young assistant U.S. attorneys to give them kind of a pep talk. He went around the room and he said, I want you all to tell me who here has never had an acquittal or a hung jury. Who has a perfect record? And a bunch of these young attorneys kind of sit up and raise their hands because they're the go-getters. They're the gunners is what we would have called them in law school. And Comey says, you know, we have a name for you guys. We like to call you the Chicken Shit Club.
Ooh, harsh.
And his suggestion there, right, is that these are people who are picking and choosing the cases that they make, and that if you're not at least occasionally getting an acquittal or a hung jury, then you're not being forward-leaning enough in terms of the types of cases you're prosecuting. I should say that I have a little bit of perspective on this, having gone to law school myself. He really kind of hones in on this aspect of the – almost the anthropology of the legal professionals out there who go to elite law schools and get jobs as federal prosecutors, which are plum jobs, confronted with two types of cases, say – an insider trading case where it may be really difficult to make the case, but the odds of you getting a conviction are relatively high, and a much more abstruse, complex case in which you're trying to prove individual criminal culpability on the part of executives who were dealing in these financial instruments that nobody really seems to have understood at all, that somebody who's had a lifetime in which they never got a B, would shy away from the latter kind of case. What I wonder, though, Sheila, is maybe you could talk to us a little bit about some of the cases that they haven't actually charged.
Right. Well, so what the financial crisis revealed to the world was that many of these major banks had been granting mortgages that they should not have, falsifying documentation, giving huge loans to people who worked as bartenders. And then they were taking all those loans, bundling them up into securities, and then they were selling them to investors all over the world. Then when the housing market started to decline, all of that just sort of collapsed. And And here we are years later. Yes, there were no charges brought against any senior level people at any of these firms. And it is stunning because many of those firms have paid billions of dollars in civil penalties. So clearly, a decision was made at some point sort of to steer away from individual charges. How is it possible that a bank would demand that its shareholders pay $16 billion in fines to the government, yet there was not an individual at that bank who could be charged with committing a crime? It just defies logic. And you can contrast that with other white-collar cases in the past that were handled very differently. Now, one that comes to mind is Enron.
Yeah.
And the Enron case was a very complicated case that took years to build. There was a dedicated group of prosecutors and FBI agents who were put on that case. They didn't have anything else they were supposed to do. They were only working on that case, and they were given resources to really follow it. And they ultimately ended up convicting Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling, the CEO and chairman of the firm. And they did not have any email evidence where those guys were saying something stupid and self-incriminating in an email. The case was much more diffuse, but they had witnesses. And just by really working hard over a long period of time, they were able to build the case without the kind of evidence that I think people have become accustomed to seeing now, which is somebody...
Smoking gun.
An email where somebody says, I know this is a criminal act and I am engaging in it. Ha ha, we got away with it. They didn't have any of that. Yet they did manage to put these two top guys in jail. And that does not happen anymore.
Amazing. So listen, I'm gonna tell you a story then. So this is largely what we've been talking about, an account of failures by the Obama administration to crack down on Wall Street and on the big banks in the aftermath of the financial crisis, a financial crisis that hit the country hard. And just a few years later, we have the rise of Donald Trump and of Trumpism. And I think most people would agree that Trump was sort of borne along on a tide of frustration and resentment of precisely the types of elites who seem to have gotten away with it during the Obama years. So tell me about the return to accountability under the Trump administration.
I think one of the reasons Donald Trump got all of the support that he did was because he really campaigned against Wall Street to some extent. And he kept saying, I'm here for the forgotten men and women of America, the little people who are suffering while all the elites reap all the rewards of this economy. And I think those were very powerful arguments. Of course, what we've seen since then, as far as I can tell, is a total reversal. He's gone and installed folks from Goldman Sachs and various hedge funds into all the key decision-making roles when it comes to economic policy. There's a lot of irony there. I mean, this is just yet another way that Trump has betrayed, I think, his voters and some of the ideas that made him appealing to a lot of people who voted for him.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if this stuff will catch up with him, with the administration, or whether we can expect any greater degree of accountability. It's fascinating because clearly you've outlined a pretty disastrous state of affairs, but I don't see the political preconditions for any real major changes. If anything, I feel as though we may double down on this kind of impunity.
Certainly the reporting I've done on this suggests that corporate crime, white-collar crime, seems to have dropped way down the list of priorities.
It's a good time to be a banker.
Staff writers Patrick Radden Keefe and Sheila Kolhatkar. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. In a moment, a walk in the park with none other than Karl Ove Knausgård. Stick around.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series.
Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Now we're going to wrap up the Radio Hour today by getting outside a little bit and showing a visitor around town.
It looks like a willow, that one.
That's a willow. Yeah,
the visitor is Carl Ove Knausgård, and if you know his name, it's for his huge autobiographical novel, six volumes worth, called My Struggle. It was an unlikely literary hit that describes the events of his life in infinite detail. Knausgård's new project is only a bit less ambitious. It's a four-part series named after the seasons, one book per season. And each book consists of dozens of short essays, reflections on the most common things addressed to his then-unborn daughter. The first book in the series is Autumn, and it was just published. When Carl Ove Knausgård was in town recently, he took a long walk with The New Yorker's Josh Rothman.
So we're in this particularly lovely spot, part of Central Park. I wonder, could you just describe where we are as best you can?
Yeah.
What you see?
No,
in front
it's
of?
It's water here, and it's kind of green. What would you say the color is? It's dark, dark green, muddy green.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't see through it, and there's a lot of leaves floating on it, which are yellow. And then you have rocks coming down. So it really is gray and green and yellow just around us. And you have some rocks with people on, and the people look extremely not in the nature. They are, you know, the colors of the clothes are very different. They are not part of this. They're coming here to see it and be seen. And then you have the skyscrapers behind, which makes it kind of incredibly beautiful. It frames it. And I would, if I'd been a painter, I would love to paint those people there. Yeah. It would have been fantastic if I could, you know. So you are also a bit confused, because if you just sit down, it is like it is. You are in a forest or in the woods somewhere. And if you look up, it is, you are in a city. And those two perspectives is hard to get together.
It's funny how Central Park has gotten more beautiful with time since when it was first laid out. There weren't these buildings.
Yeah.
So it was more of just a park. You were just in a park.
Yeah.
It didn't have the same uniqueness that it has now, I guess. You know.
But it also made me feel sad a bit, because it is in a city, you know. It is something, I don't know why that is, but if I should write about it, I would have written about that, I think.
The feeling that it's a little sad.
Yeah, a little sad it is.
No, I know what you mean, and it always has a slightly, like, artificial vibe.
Yeah,
a little bit
but
of
but it's also strange. Why shouldn't we embrace the artificial? I mean, that's wonderful, isn't it? We have created it, and it is made, and it is great. But I do feel that often. It's the same with the internet. I do have this same sadness when I think of it.
It makes you sad, the internet makes you sad.
Yeah,
yeah.
It does. It keeps my children indoor, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, me too.
And just over there, I think it is, must be a cherry tree, isn't it not? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which I wrote about in one of the books, when they blossom.
Yeah,
shy they are when they blossom. You don't see them now, it's just part of the green. And then they can become incredibly beautiful and blossoming and with a kind of a shyness to them. Which is, to me, you know, it's like being... Yeah, my daughter is that age. She's 13. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of blossoming somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And she's being aware of how beautiful she is. And that's the quality of a cherry tree somehow, if you know what I mean.
the origin of this book seems like it's partly being a father.
Yeah.
It's like about children, and you capture so much of what it's like to think and feel when you're young. But I wonder if you could just say something about how do you think the way that children live is different from the way that adults live?
You know, I have 4 children, mm-hmm. and maybe when I spend a summer day with them, it's, to me, it is like nothing. It is like just, time is just passing, and there's nothing remarkable happening. It's like the world is not attached to me, or I'm not attached to the world anymore. Mm-hmm. And then I remember the summer days when I was a child myself, how important everything were and how attached I was to what happened, and how slowly those days evolved somehow. And I find it very easy to underestimate my children, mm-hmm. that I don't see them. They're just, you know, little creatures, and, you know, not realizing that they have a enormous, huge and independent inner life, mm-hmm. which somehow I think the task as a parent is to be aware of that. Mm-hmm.
Is it ever hard to re-engage with your family life after you've been secluded in your writing?
No, because it is part of the same. I mean, they run in and out, and I never isolate, you know, physically when they are there.
Yeah.
When at school, I do. When I was young, I believed in that. So then I went out to islands and lighthouses and wrote and was completely alone and thought that was what it took to be a writer. In solitude, but now it's the opposite. I mean, I've never written so much as I had when I have children. Mm. So it's like just flowing with children and words.
Why is that? Like, what is it about being surrounded by the kids that makes it somehow easier?
Well, you have to lower your, you know, self-criticism. You can't afford it. You have just to write when you can write, and that's such a good thing. Mm. It's like. The notion of a masterpiece is no longer relevant. Hmm. It's just have to write today.
Just what you can do.
Yeah.
In that time.
And that's a liberating thing, really.
Yeah.
So you were saying earlier that you had been in Albania to witness a brain surgery. Could you explain what were you doing there?
I read this book by a British neurosurgeon called Henry Marsh, and the book is called Do No Harm, and I was really, really taken by it. And then a newspaper asked me, you know, do you want to write for us, and what do you want to write? And I said, I want to meet him. Then I was in touch with him, and he said, well, I'm going to Albania and Nepal, and you can meet me there. And I did. So I traveled down to Albania, and I witnessed 2 brain surgeries there.
What did you think when you saw the brain exposed in the surgical theater?
It was, first of all, it was extremely beautiful, which I didn't expect. I saw it through, you know, magnifying lens. So it was like landscapes, like you were seeing a landscape, but the rivers were red, and there was a kind of a white, it looked like a glacier, you know, and then the red river come flushing over it, and it was incredibly beautiful, and the white glacier was, of course, you know, the cancer.
Right.
Yeah. So it was very weird and strange and very beautiful.
So it really was like he describes in the book,
yeah.
Henry Marsh, yeah. Because he talks about that it's this, he says it's like the arches of a cathedral, the veins, it's actually it's incredible.
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
But when you see it from a, you know, without that, it's just a gray lump, it is nothing. And then you open it up and it is absolutely magical.
What's
oh, it? Look at that.
Oh.
It's a turtle.
It's a turtle.
Yeah. Just ahead, a above the water, and the head is like a snake, so it's I hate snakes, so it's a bit... Oh, no, it's diving down. You heard me. It disappeared completely.
It's pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm going to remember. That turtle.
There he is.
Oh. Oh, it is a strange creature.
What is it that's so strange about the... about the turtle?
It's the age. They're so incredibly old species. But that he or she is very young. That kind of amazed me. Also with frogs. You sense a certain... there's a certain primitive thing, but not to him or her. It's not primitive at all. It is them and their life. And I just feel it's so strange to be contemporary to sharks and turtles and snakes and frogs. And
it's funny, yeah, moments like that where, because I think this is a theme in the book too, where it's like the things that are almost eternal kind of next to the things that are very transient.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think that the world is a kind of unchanging place? Like, when you look at a turtle like that, it makes you think, or these rocks here.
Yeah.
Does it feel to you like we're just sort of temporary visitors in an ancient place? Or how do you think about the age of the world?
I never asked myself that question. I was just made me think of something, because I was in a reception in London. It was full of people and it was very hot, and I fainted. I didn't know I was fainting, of course. I just like that, and it was when I came back, there was a lot of people above me looking at me, and it was like I was in darkness still, and I couldn't understand where I was. I didn't know who I was. I had no idea, and I wondered if I was, you know, in another dimension looking at those people, and I couldn't relate to it. And it was like, and then I thought I must be dead, and this must be something from my childhood I'm remembering. And it was so intense, because I was also surrounded by darkness. It was like they were looking at you, and I couldn't relate to anything. And then kind of I fell in, and then it was okay again. But I think that's the closest I've come to, I think that must be how it is to be dead. Not looking back, but just the blackness that comes. It's
all
like it just, yeah, it's like it's like it was something black coming like that, and then it is nothing. It's just gone.
Can we go this way, or does it end? This is pretty here, isn't it?
The New Yorker's Josh Rothman with the Norwegian writer Karl Ove Knausgård. His new book of essays is called Autumn, and the next volume, Winter, will be out in the winter. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Glad you could join us today, and I hope you come by next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Sarah Sandbach, Jessica Henderson, Terrence Bernardo, and Corey Schreppel. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.